Welcome to The Neutral Ground. You've heard me talk on this podcast about neo-modernism and how we're moving into a realm of yearning for narrative reassurance, for stories that challenge us to think about right and wrong, good versus evil, and asks us to consider what that even means. Our guest this week is author Kevin M. Kraft, and he is, in my opinion, a neo-modern author, an individual who is writing stories about heroism, about suffering, about struggle, about strength, and about faith. And just because it isn't postmodern, it doesn't mean that it is without complexity. Kraft's works require and/or demand a strong connection with the reader. You have to think while you're reading his works. And I encourage anyone who is looking for inspiration to be more heroic, to be closer to family, and to be prepared to heed the call to adventure when life throws adversity your way, to consider reading Kevin's books, and to take in a little neo-modern motivation. Now, if you appreciate my work on this podcast and the conversation, slide your finger over to the subscribe button. Like Dobro, one of Kevin's heroes, slides his fingers up and down the strings of his cigar box guitar before he is about to bring justice to those who cause great suffering in the world. Or you can simply click the subscribe or follow button with your mouse. It's up to you, really. If you're so moved to do so, there is a list of ways that you can help support the podcast in the episode description, along with links to Kevin's works. But more than anything, I appreciate the time that you're giving me right now. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kevin M. Kraft. Kevin, welcome to The Neutral Ground. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Well, I wanted to have you on because even though I don't talk a lot about kind of modern writing, there are certain aspects of your particular writing that spoke to me, and then I've even talked about on the podcast with my audience as well. Some of that being narrative clarity or narrative assurance. You offer very clear narratives that we can follow and get behind, and I think that speak to a yearning that we have today for clarity and for challenging us in a particular way in this idea of a, dare I say, an old-fashioned kind of narrative of good versus evil, and how do we as human beings confront evil? Well, we grow through strength and adversity, through connections with our loved ones, with human beings, and even with our faith. And that really spoke to me and why I wanted you to have you on here today. Now, I want to begin because I love professionals in everywhere. And I want to ask you a little bit about your journey, if you can talk with us about how did you, what was your journey like becoming an author? Did you always love writing?
Yes, always. As long as I can remember, I loved great storytelling from a very early age. My dad used to read me Bible stories and everything. My older brother used to tell great stories. And I had teachers, you know, in kindergarten and stuff that read. And I remember very early on thinking, man, I love great stories. And I'd love to be able to be someone who could tell, who would be a great storyteller. And I remember thinking that from really early on, like kindergarten, first grade. And as it came about at around, you know, third or fourth grade, I started to exhibit storytelling ability with my, you know, writing assignments from my teachers and stuff. And I'd regale my teachers and my fellow classmates alike with stories. By the time I was 10 years old, I had written my first novel. I put it in quotes because I was just a kid. I taught myself how to type. A typewriter, you know, those some things. If you remember what those are.
Oh yeah.
And my parents bought me one for Christmas. And I remember I beat that thing to death. I wrote so much short stories, and I think I wrote my first novel when I was 10 or 11. And I always loved storytelling, and that continued right up until now. So yeah, I was always writing something.
The writing kind of teacher in me wants to ask you, this is a follow-up. Do you find, because one of the things that we try to teach even college students is that writing is not simply about expression. Writing is also in many ways the highest form of thinking that we can do. And oftentimes my students will laugh at this. I'm always yelling at them. It doesn't matter if you don't know what you think. Just start writing. And eventually your mind will start clarifying where it needs to go because every word has to connect in meaningful ways. Do you find that also when you're writing, you're doing your best thinking as well?
Yeah, I think so. I'm certainly doing my most powerful and energetic thinking because I'm, you know, I tell people that I teach it as well, that it's one thing to write and it's another thing to write information. And it's another thing to craft words. And that's what a lot of people don't make that connection, you know? And it's like, you know, anybody can write information. I told my own kids when they started writing, my daughter's a novelist as well. And my eldest daughter. And I remember telling her early on, it's like, you know, I'm reading her work. I was like, okay, you're writing down good information, but I want you to tell me a story. I want you to lead me through this story using the words as your vehicle. And I think she got it, you know, and most people, like once I explained it, I think they finally get it. I also tell people too, it's like, everybody can write, not everybody's a writer, you know, and not every writer can write fiction, you know, you got textbook writers, they can write that, but fiction writers, that's a whole different kind of class of writing. But I'm very, very interested in word crafting, being a wordsmith. And hopefully I've mastered that at least to some degree. I always hope to do more of that, but that's something, yes, that's definitely something that is very important to me. It's being able to craft a narrative, craft words, tell a story that is compelling and gets people, you know, pulls people through the journey of the characters that I create. So,
yeah. And the thoughtfulness can definitely be seen in your writing. It comes out of the page. It really does. So let's jump into this a little bit here. And I want to begin by talking about your character Dobro, right? And specifically the first novel, The Bottlenecker. And I want to do our best here to not spoil things because I want people to get this on their own a little bit. So we'll talk mostly thematically here a little bit and just kind of get an understanding of how you arrived here. So let me begin here. I want to say I come from a place where I've studied as part of my own research for a long time, the epic hero, specifically from all the way from Gilgamesh in Mesopotamia through Milton and Paradise Lost. And so I love the warrior man of faith or individual person of faith, that kind of warrior figure. I find that to be the most compelling. I always have. I want to ask you about the origin here. Maybe first a creative question. Where did this character Dobro come from within you? What was it that called you to write this kind of archetypal figure?
Dobro he's kind of a mosaic of all of my loves. I love my family and my daughter, of course, my daughters, my kids. So that's where I find his core. I'm a man of faith, of course. But there are also things about him that I love. I love his hat that he wears. I wear the same hats, you know. I love the music he plays, you know, the cigar box guitar and the blues and everything, slide guitar. That's me. I like resilience, you know, like the phoenix coming out of entity and really losing everything to emerge stronger than he was and better than he was before in a lot of ways, despite his disability and being visually impaired. But I love, you know, the martial arts and everything has always been a real, real big fascination with me. So he embodies all of my loves, you know, in this one character. As a matter of fact, I can even say that Dobro is me. If I were to go through what Dobro went through, I would be like him. And so a lot of his responses would probably be my responses, at least by my estimation, if I were to go through the same things that Dobro did. So that's where he comes from. I think he finally coalesced when I became a parent. And my daughter was my firstborn. My daughter was born, and I just all the instincts and the internal responses of being a father to this little girl, and all that entails. You know, I kind of transferred myself into Dobro's character too, and you know, with his responses that come to his daughter and the story and his family. And everything. So yeah, he's very much me.
I don't want to overstate this, but I find it really fascinating what you just said. And I'm wondering, at a certain point, while you were sort of writing yourself in this character a little bit, was the character also imprinting on you as well as you wrote it? Did you find yourself kind of also, dare I say, like kind of learning from the character or more about yourself from the character?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, because we are very closely. I'm very closely tied to the character, and so as I'm, it would seem almost crazy to somebody who doesn't write, but when I write, it's almost as if I have two brains. The one brain is writing the story, and the other brain is reacting to what is happening in the story, as if I'm watching a movie or I'm watching myself, and so. And very, very often there'll be something that'll happen. And especially in character of Dobro, where like, he'll do something, right? I'll write it. And it's like, oh, I can't believe he did that. It'll surprise me, but I'll learn more about myself because it's me. Dobro is a lot of me is in Dobro. And so his reactions are mine. And I'm realizing, yeah, there's, you know, I have respect for Dobro and what he went through, you know? And I'm just like, yeah, that's, you know, I admire him in some ways, quite frankly, you know, because of what he's gone through and what his character goes through. I can relate to that, you know, quite definitely. So
it's amazing to me that power that writing has. I mean, there's a reason why we've been writing for as long as we have as a species in all manner of ways, you know, journals and diaries, things like that. It really does help us understand better kind of the world around us and provides us a wonderful space to work out potential problems too. And it reminded me also of, I had a guest on named Angus Fletcher, who wrote this wonderful book called Wonderworks. And this book is basically a study of how literature has helped us in various ways to deal with loss as actual tools, is his argument, that they're actual tools that we've created along thousands of years to help us be heroic. And that's also one of the things that your book even made me think of. And even just what you said was how reading can be so powerful in helping us be courageous and connect with that larger species of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And in many ways, I found myself wanting to aspire to be like Dobro in some ways, you know? So he's, yeah, I get what you're saying. You're absolutely correct. Yes.
I would love to be like Dobro too. Actually, it's a fantastic character. Well, let me get a little more specific than here even. So you have a character named Sujin, and Sujin actually is quite a great human being, very approachable and loving and caring. And she helps Dobro quite a bit at the beginning when he's kind of suffering and trying to get better. But there's this interesting exchange at the beginning when they meet. They both kind of question differences in culture and even in ethnicity. But as Dobro is sort of at his height of suffering, he's crying out and he's calling out to God. And Sujin remembers that she had done a similar thing. And we're reminded about how much the human being is bound to this connection of suffering and loss. Can you talk a little bit about how suffering and loss functions in the world of your works?
Yeah, it's very much a central theme in a lot of my work. More specifically, I'm constantly, you know, I'm constantly addressing the fact that, you know, things happen to us that, you know, we may regard as bad or painful, suffering, you know, as the Bible says, in this life, you will have suffering. And, you know, very oftentimes things will happen to us that we question. We don't know why they happen. They seem to, you know, like God lowers the boom on us every once in a while, just to, you know, and we're not always given answers as to why, you know, except to know that, you know, nothing touches our life without first passing through the hands of God, no matter what it is. And that's both a statement of faith. It's also pretty scary sometimes, you know, when things do happen to us, that we're like, what in the world? Where did this come from? Why is this happening to me? And we sometimes get no answers. And so a very well-visited theme of mine is, you know, trust God no matter what, you know, understanding that it passes through God first to touch you, and that he has his reasons. He may not always explain them to us, you know. So that's a very important thing. And God, you know, he wants us to cry out to him. He's a loving father. And so, you know, he suffers with us, even as he's allowing this to happen to us, you know, and he's there to bear us up at the same time. He hears our cry. And so it's almost like, you know, very often in our stories, modern day stories, you know, there's always a neat wrap up. You know, and everything's explained and everything's worked out and, oh, you know, and a happy ending. It's like, well, that real life isn't like that, you know? And so I try to reflect that in my novels and with the characters, you know, putting them through things as I guess God, you know, they're God. I'm kind of like, you know, putting them through things and I'm not explaining to them why, but I'm observing them and I'm compassionate toward them and I'll, you know, I'll help them. It's almost blasphemous to say, but I've told people, it's like, you know, the one thing I love about the creator is that he's placed in his creation the ability to create in us. And we, in a very small sense, at least, as fiction writers, as we create characters and everything, we kind of understand a little bit what it's like to be God and to create characters and to create their situation, create the world. And I think that almost, it's a blessing to see that, because it's like, you know, we don't explain things to our characters all the time, you know, and God doesn't, he's not required to do so either, but we have faith in him and we trust him anyway. We know he loves us, you know, he cares. He has a greater purpose that we can't even possibly fathom. And, you know, but we're just playing our part in it. And, you know, sometimes God only knows is the best answer we can have. And it is the best answer we have. So, yeah, that's kind of what I try to place in all of my books, is that idea.
When I was reading through the book, the Bottlenecker, there's a point in the book where our hero has, you know, lost pretty much everything. And I thought you were going to do a very modern thing, but you didn't. Because kind of the very postmodern, modern thing, whenever, I'll say it this way, because I've talked about this on the show, the postmodern reading of the hero is very complex. And in postmodernism, I think when people have tried to write that kind of man of faith warrior, it tends to become very flat. And the reason why it reads flat, to me at least, and you can comment on this as well, is because either they make the character too faithfully perfect, as if they understand everything. They've got this grand clarity that no one even in the Bible had. Or they dilute the faith so much that you kind of are left thinking, well, wait a second, do you have a structure of faith there at all? In which case, what exactly are you kind of struggling with? What you did, that was why I thought it was fascinating, was you keep the substructure of faith underneath the character at all times. And that creates a true drama, a true problem, a grappling, because the hero can't simply dismiss the faith and say, I'm going to do my own thing. To do so would be like dismissing a truth, like dismissing gravity in some way. And that is what actually creates the beautiful struggle, I think that you have in the novel. Can you talk a little bit about your kind of either the comment itself or the creative part of maintaining that substructure?
No, I appreciate you saying that. I've explained it in this way to other people who have noticed that, is that, very often Christian writers, I'll say in particular, write a story with a message in mind, you know, and then everything that they write is built up, packed around that message. And it becomes very, very heavy handed, and it becomes almost, unnatural and, unrelatable in some ways. But what I try to do is I create characters. In this case, Ndobro, he's a believer, that much is clear. He's probably more of a believer after he goes through what he goes through. But I don't have a message in mind. I let the message come organically through watching this character and his actions, And so it isn't perfect all the time, but he's faithful, And I think that's why people relate to my characters in my books. Even those who aren't believers get that. It's not that I'm trying to beat them over a head with a particular Bible message. Is I'm letting the characters live their story, and their actions determine, what message, whatever message the reader gets from it. But that's very important, to me. I'm less interested as a novelist to control my characters as I am to let them live, let them move, and I'm interested too sometimes in seeing what the outcome is. I don't always have an outcome with each novel that I write. I very much write by the seat of my pants. And so I'm surprised when I get to the end sometimes, that's how I work. But I think that's why people respond so well to my writings, because they don't feel like they're being preached to. They're just watching the story, or they're watching this character who happens to be a believer live out his faith, And I don't know if that's so much a statement about myself or my characters, but hey, it works. And I think, people get a lot more out of it because of that.
So let me ask you about a little bit about this, because again, something you said really made me think here. I think does writing, because you don't shy away from including that you write with a context of faith in mind. You don't shy away from that. And so is it in some ways then perhaps easier to let the faith come through if you write from the perspective of the character, as opposed to writing from the perspective of the faith and then fitting a character around that? Is it more freeing, you think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It's the world to me that I create seems, it seems real, I'm not trying to create the faith, as it were. It's already a part of my world, and I just plug it into this world, And how are these people going to respond or react to what I put them through? Be it a person, a man who loses everything, his family and everything in his sight, or somebody that's that's fleeing from a big 7-foot hairy monster. It's like, okay, so how do these people of faith react in this situation? Whatever fantastic situation I can think to plug them in. So.
Well, when you are writing then from the seat of your pants and you're stopping at a particular point of crisis, let's say, can I ask you what is your process by which you try to think through how the character would authentically react here?
If it's somebody like Dobro, who's very close to me, I simply sit and think, okay, how would I react? And I really put myself through it. It's like, this has happened to me. How do I react? How might I react? And, that's how I approach it a lot of the times. If it's somebody that's a little different from me, and I can't think of too many protagonists that are that much different from me, that I have to think too hard about it. But if somebody that's a little different from me, I'll kind of say, okay, now if I were this person, and I lived this life or had these if this was a reality in my life, you know, that isn't in, really in mine, then how would I react? So I'm pretty good at kind of just putting on the skin of someone, you know, of some, another character, even if it's with somebody different from me, because even the villains that I write are, you know, are me in some way. And so I kind of just put on the skin and say, okay, I'm this person. How would I react if I were them? And that's kind of how I think through, you know, those processes is, what would I do?
Yeah. And what you just said too, I hadn't thought of it before this way, but you are a very archetypal kind of writer. And when you just said that sometimes even the villain, I'm in the villain as well, it made me think of right now, what's very big is people like to talk about the psychoanalyst Carl Gustav Jung again. People like to talk about Jung. And Jung is all about the collective unconscious and the archetypal figures. And what I connected with here was your character, Dr. Bake, who is Sujin's father and represents this kind of wise old man figure. And what I liked about him, of course, is he's entertaining for one thing. He's brash, he's blunt, he's upfront, he tells you exactly the truth that maybe you don't want to hear. And that made me want to ask you this. One, was it difficult to write a character who's so kind of, let's say, insensitive? Because he is kind of insensitive here. What was it difficult to write that? And is there a commentary in there from you about maybe something that we're missing or at least need a little bit more of, you think, today?
Yeah, to answer your first question, it wasn't that hard to write because I know that, you know, I've been in situations, you know, in adverse situations myself, be it a physical challenge or an emotional challenge, where I had to really, you know, talk to myself and tell myself things that I didn't want to hear at the time, you know. You got to get up, you know, you've got to get over this. You've got to stop feeling sorry for yourself. And all those types of things, you know, that I've had to say to myself or that somebody has said to me in so many words. Beck is taken to an extreme, which is what made him so entertaining to write. Cause he said some things that even I wouldn't say to myself, you know, but I think that he's interesting to write. But yeah, I think we live in a culture, and it pains me to see it, where people are more given into their emotions. And, you know, some of us use the term snowflake to describe the younger generation because that's they're taught that their feelings are the most important thing in the universe. And anything that they hear or somebody says that doesn't make them feel good or worse makes them feel bad is bad, you know. And so they're you know, it's like everything they want everything to be easy. They want everything to be nice and to be sweet. And that is just not life. And you won't get any very far in life with that as your philosophy. But we see it in our culture a lot, you know, it's like people, you know, they have no control over their emotions because their emotions are everything. And so they're given to their emotions, you know, and then because of it, they're weak, they're easily triggered. That word so much, easily triggered. Triggered used to be a term that was only used for war veterans. And yet people use it every day to describe how they feel at a certain moment about a little thing that they heard that hurt their feelings or didn't make them feel good. I'm triggered. I hate that. I do. I hate that. And I don't want to see that. And I certainly don't want to see that in myself. And so, you know, I think that it's something, yeah, we definitely need to get back to people saying, you know, there's a time where you need to just grow up and you need to realize that your feelings are driven by the wind, quite frankly. Somebody changes a light in the room, your feelings are going to change, you know, and you can't live that way. That's not a realistic way to live. It's not a healthy way to live. And I think it would be great if we started teaching, especially our children, that, you know, we got a whole generation that is just emotionally driven and it has done no good for our culture. It's done no good for them. So that's where I am with that.
Yeah. So one of the things that that I try to build in my students is resiliency. And the way that I do that at the beginning of the semester is we do a lot of, in addition to notes and writing and discussions, we do a lot of group challenge exercises where I will purposefully put a timer as big as I can make it on the projector. And at the beginning of the semester, I'll ask them, does that make you anxious? And I'll get a lot of, yeah, it kind of does. I said, okay, that's okay. That's all right. Your goal is going to be, by the end of the semester, to look at that as nothing more than time and numbers. And when you go into a chaotic situation, I want you to feel like you can assert some order on chaos and take control of that moment. And I have to say, the students, at least in my experience, have done a pretty wonderful job overall when you do challenge them to say, hey, let's learn from this. Let's build up this resiliency. They have it in them to do it. And they're wonderfully courageous with that. In some ways, I do wonder if we just need to challenge them more.
I think you're right. I know I used to work at a children's hospital out here, a children's psychiatric hospital. And I was amazed how receptive the kids were when you challenged them. And like you said, kids are naturally resilient. That's just something that God places in them. They have to be. Because they've learned in this culture not to be, you know, to be easily disturbed, to be easily upset, to be easily triggered, you know, and I sit down with them because they, some of them have come in because of, you know, they were triggered by something, you know, didn't get what they want for Christmas. The other parents said no, or something about something, you know, and I'll sit down and talk to them, you know, and I'll listen to them. You know, I'm very, you know, I can listen and I'm, you know, nodding. Yeah. You know, what about this? I ask some questions and everything. And I usually get to a question like, okay. So when your parents said no to you, did that hurt you? And they're like, well, yeah. I said, well, why? Because I didn't get what I wanted. And I said, well, do you always think you're going to get what you want in life? And sometimes they'll act like it'll be like they never heard that before, or you know, it's like yeah, you know, you won't always get what you want, but you know, you got to expect that, and you can't let not getting what you want all the time, you know, tie you down or defeat you, you know, so I'm always surprised whenever I get the kids like that, and they're like, no, yeah, I guess you're right, you know, and it's like because they're taught. They're not taught these things like they should be.
Yeah, I agree. I think we definitely forget how resilient young people are, young adults and children in general, and how they can take a lot more than we give them credit for, quite honestly. And they can do wonderful things, and we should expect wonderful things from them, to be honest. So yeah, we're in agreement there. I want to talk about this father-son, because this also even connects back, and we'll transition a little bit from Dobro here even into your novel Momo as well, but we can kind of move back and forth a little bit if you want here. The way you depict father-son relationships I found to be incredibly uplifting, and I even just had a conversation with an author of really young children books named Ashley Finley, who wrote this beautiful book about the love of a father. And she just focused on that, the unconditional love of a father. That's what it was called. And this relationship between fathers and children just to me seems to have become so simplified. Whereas trying to think about being a good father, let alone the actual relationship itself, but just trying to think about what does it mean to be a good father is complex enough. When we simplify it too much, we really do reduce, I think, the father to simply a cardboard cutout. And what I appreciated, especially with Momo, with your novel Momo, was the relationship between Mark and Evan. Mark is actively trying, to his detriment, really. He's trying too hard to think about what it means to be a good father. Can you talk a little bit first about what it was that made you get into that conversation and write, let's say, Momo, or write about that relationship?
I think, again, it occurred after I became a parent. And I began to, you know, you think even as a youth, you know, when I have kids, you know, I'm going to fill in the blank, you know? And, but it isn't until you have children that you realize how nuanced it is, how complex it is. It isn't a, you know, I'm a father, you know, do what I say, you know, and, you know, obey me and that kind of stuff. It's so much more layered than that and so much more complicated than that, that I started, you know, when it came to the father and son, I was tempted to make it just a kind of a real straightforward father-son relationship, you know. But then I thought, you know, even with my own kids, I had to learn. And that's when I had more than one kid. When you have two, like Bill Cosby says, I don't call one, somebody that has one child really a parent, because there's too many things, you know, missing. But when you have two kids, you have to learn how to love each child individually as well as collectively, because they're two totally different individuals with a whole different set of rules and schematics and everything. One of the biggest mistakes I made was trying to treat my third born similar to my first born because they had similar personalities, and that didn't work at all. And I realized, my gosh, you know, I mean, this isn't just a one book, you know, parenting style handbook. I've got four now. By now, I got four individual kids that have their own vast book, you know, and their own vast you know, makeup that I have to learn. And so, when it came to writing Mark and Evan, I thought, you know, it's so easy for us to try to fit our kids into our mold or the mold that we make for them. And in so doing, yeah, sure, we may love them, but we may inadvertently demonstrate to them that we don't like them as they are. You know, we want them to be like this or like we are or something like that. And it's very easy to do because that's easier, right? You know, for them to be like us. That's kind of what I wanted to write that into Mark and Evan's roles. And to tell you the truth, I got a lot of response from that, from readers about, they said that made me think of my relationship with my father and my relationship with my sons. And I was like, wow, I didn't realize I touched upon something, you know, as electric as that. But yeah, that's a very important element in the relationship. And it makes them sympathetic because people can relate, you know, to them in some way, shape or form. So
I'm not surprised that people reached out to you about that in a very positive way, because like I said, I think it's just, we tend to think of the father figure as such a simplified form today somewhat, that I could see where people would really appreciate having a bit more complexity in thinking about, first, what does it mean to be a good father? And then to think about, how do I apply that, right? Because again, he's a flawed individual, Mark, in the sense, but flawed in a nice way, a meaningful way. He wants to do good. He really does. And so you're also exploring something that we don't see often in any media, writing or even movie or TV. This concept of, usually when we see a father who has done wrong, let's say, it's a pretty clear narrative that it's wrong. Like, it's bad what they did. This was wrong, but in a meaningful, good-intentioned way. And I want people to really understand, I think, how uplifting even that is for someone to hear, that it's okay to be wrong. And your intentions do matter here, but you can still be wrong and rectify it. Can you talk even a little bit about, was there a thought process there in how to make Mark a flawed character?
Yeah. Beyond what I said, I kind of looked at myself, you know, as a father, you want to be the perfect dad, you know, and you don't want to make any major mistakes. You certainly don't want to be wrong. if you can help it. But, you know, there are times that I am, you know, and I had to learn really early on, even when they're just, you know, just barely walking, you know, where you have to, you know, you have to be able to, I think that's one of the most important things for a child to hear early on in their childhood. This is for a father, especially, to say, I'm sorry. I was wrong. I was totally mistaken. I am so sorry about that. You know, that makes a big difference. And I think that it's sad that, and probably a lot of kids don't hear that from their father. It's always, you know, even when they're obviously wrong, that they won't admit it, you know, because they feel that that's a sign of weakness, or it's a sign of it's taking authority away from them as the parent or something. But, you know, I think just, that's very important. That was important. I wanted to get that, you know, into Mark's character too, that, you know, when it's all said and done, he can admit, you know, that he's wrong and make changes when necessary. So yeah, that was very important for me.
Evan, in many ways, because Mark is dealing with a generational kind of problem here as well, between his father and then passing that down to Evan. Let me ask you kind of a writing question and a psychology of your character here. Does Evan break a chain there of events where you have the anxiety of the father continuing downward to the son or to the child? Does Evan break that link?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it does so, like when Mark can admit, you know, that he was wrong, at least in his method. And, you know, I think, yeah, apologizing to him, I think Evan now it was demonstrated to Evan that, you know, yeah, you know, I can be a father and I can be wrong and admit it and still be the father, still be a good father. As a matter of fact, be a good father because of it. And so, yeah, I think that in my mind, that chain was broken with Evan.
That's wonderful. And you're providing hope to others as well at the same time. Something else that I loved particularly about this book, one of my favorite books in the Old Testament is the book of Job. I love it. I could read that over and over and over again constantly and get something new every single time. And of course, in Momo, you mentioned this. And in doing so, you set up our minds to be thinking about the book of Job as well. And where that spoke to me is, and again, I want to be careful not to give stuff away, but I'll just say, toward the very end, Mark is in a very bad situation, and he's separated from Evan, and he's confronted with a very the 7-foot monster here that you mentioned earlier, and he's thankful. It's a fantastic little nuanced moment here that harkens to something that many people who read the book of Job struggle with constantly. This idea of how can you be in some way thankful for adversity that just seems absolutely ridiculous to do so. And yet here's your character in this beautiful line. He's seeing the adversity in front of him and he says, thank you, Lord, for this. Can you talk more about that conceptual state of mind of being thankful for adversity there?
Yeah. I learned it from Job, obviously, because, you know, Job's situation is where he loses everything and then some, and yet he still worships God, you know? And I mean, he's to the point where his wife is even telling him, you know, just curse God and die, you know, and he rebukes her for that. That's a constant thing that you find in the Bible about always giving thanks to the Lord, you know, and rejoicing in the Lord always, you know, and again, it goes back to what I was saying before.
That's okay.
Something came up on my screen. Yeah, it's the whole idea of, you know, trusting God and believing God no matter what. And so that was really important to me. I've been in situations myself, you know, again, I draw from experience and, you know, adverse situations that I've had where, you know, even in the midst of the worst of it, you know, be somehow being able to, you know, to bless the Lord, oh my soul, you know, and in all things give thanks. You know, it's totally counterintuitive. You know, it's totally opposite of what our human nature tells us. And that's the point. You know, it is something, it is joy that transcends anything else. And it's joy that is promised, you know, to those who love God, you know. And so I have learned in certain situations, you know, that I had that within me, thank God. And so I think that, and it's something that I don't think it's necessarily, it's something that's not taught a lot, even from the pulpit, you know, rejoicing in the Lord always, giving thanks for all things, not just some things, but for all things, you know, and again, realizing that nothing touches our life, nothing touches our life without passing through the hands of God. And in that, being able to rejoice in the Lord and to, you know, to praise God regardless. That's what the apostles learned, you know. And their example was Jesus himself, you know. But you look and listen to their stories, you know, that they faced awful, you know, adversity and hardships because of their faith, but that they continued to worship God and praise God and testify of God no matter what they faced. And they're our example. And so I thought it's important for me to realize that in myself. And that was important for me to impart to other people as well. And that's why I think it makes it kind of interesting too, you know, by adding a dimension of a you know, a cryptid, you know, monster, is that, okay, so what if that happened, you know, to me? Well, how would I respond as a believer? You know, and, you know, anything that we face, you know, I think we need to kind of have that filter, you know, in our head, you know, it's like, okay, this is coming. This is passing through God's hands. How am I going to respond?
Hmm. Yeah, I think it is, of course, it's easy to say love adversity when you're not in an adverse situation. We know that, right? But the couple of times that I have had that wonderful clarity of thought in a bad situation, it has given me a tremendous amount of strength to think, put it on the cross, and let that kind of hold the weight. And you can kind of approach many terrible situations, I think, that way, and draw a tremendous amount of strength. And I really, again, this was one of those situations where I thought, as a writer, you could have gone another way, as a modern writer, let's say. But you didn't. You held your ground and kept that substructure there. And I think the book benefits tremendously from the faith that you had in your own characters in that regard. And why I think people, again, I'm not surprised that people would have very positive things to say about your work here. Well, we'll move a little bit toward the close here of our conversation. And I want to say thank you, of course, for being on. But I also want to ask you about, are there current projects you're working on and other things in your mind that you could share with our audience?
Yeah, some of the things I can, sure. I'm working on the fourth book in the Dobro series, you know. So that's my biggest project, my biggest challenge right now. I'm going to be opening up a line of books for younger readers, probably like middle school and young adult readers. I got that idea actually from Momo, because Momo won a couple of book awards. One was for teen reading, another one's for young adults. And I thought, well, you know, I can do this. And I wrote some other books in the past that I'm going to be re-releasing that were actually geared more towards younger readers of that same age bracket. So I'm going to re-release those and open up a line for younger readers. Going to write a book about that's like a creative writing instruction book, you know, how to write effective, you know, creative writing. So I'm going to be working on that now, actually. I'm taking it from a workshop that I used to do for the public library here about creative writing, different aspects, you know, one for youth and one for adults. And for Christian writers and for this and that and everything. So I'm going to kind of compile those in a short guide. And some other things I'm thinking about doing next year after that. I want to do a novel, a fictionalized version of the life of Adam and Eve after the fall, what life must have been like for them, you know, east of Eden, as it were. So that's what I'm really looking forward to. I've been wanting to do that for years, and I've been thinking about it. It's been percolating in my head and fermenting and everything. And I think it could be really a really powerful, what they call the, I don't know what they're called, but nobody's done that that I know of, and I'm surprised because just the very idea, you know, what was it like for Adam and Eve after the fall? You know, what was the relationship like? How did it change? What challenges did they face after their expulsion from paradise and everything? It just really calls to me to write. So that'll be my biggest challenge probably.
The two things that I love there. First, I love the fact that you're turning your attention to like kind of young adult, because they are craving. They're craving that kind of clarity of narrative and a little bit less of the complexity that we've been seeing in postmodern writing, this neo-modern writing of clarity of narrative and purpose and trying to figure out, kind of questing to a degree, even a journey. And I definitely think that you could do that and add quite a lot of richness to their lives. So I think that's fantastic. The idea too of kind of the day after the fall as well is fascinating also, because that could be very helpful to people who feel like they have fallen. And to think about, again, reading and writing, it's not just entertainment. There are passages, there are ways into trying to figure out what it means to be human and what does it mean to me to be human. There are ways of experiencing the world. And I think that could be very helpful for people as well. I think those are fantastic ideas.
Thank you.
Well, Kevin, you've been very grateful, you've been very genuine, generous, excuse me, with your time. And I'm grateful to you for that. I'll be putting links to your works in the episode notes, and I look forward to hearing more about your works in the future. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a real honor to speak with you finally. I was looking forward to this, and I wasn't disappointed.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kevin M. Kraft. If you did, check out Kevin's works using the links that I've provided in the episode description section. And also consider following me on social media. Oftentimes I provide background notes on the show, some motivational thoughts from my favorite authors and philosophers, and I also give a song of the week with the hope of changing our algorithms a little bit on these social media platforms.